as Steph has said, in the last hour we were thinking about the evidence for the resurrection and thinking about what kind of evidence is it and what would it look like for someone to believe in it. What would happen to reason and logic and so on if you were to believe these things were true. I hope at least this much was clear. I'm not overly optimistic about how far I moved someone, but I wonder if you would at least agree that the New Testament writers thought they were talking about something in space-time history. That they used language and said things that they at least believe they were talking about an event that happened in space and time. They had other language available to them if they wanted to talk about religious experiences or private mystical experiences. They didn't use that language. They used the language of public truth, of something that happened under Pontius Pilate on a morning, on a Sunday, before it was dawn. I think it's uncontestable or highly improbable that they didn't think that what they were saying was true. But the question I want to ask in this hour is, so what? What if it was true? And what if they thought it was true? And what if it was true? So what? What difference would it make if a guy was raised from the dead on that first Easter morning? Why would it matter? What would it change in a life if that were true? And in the last hour, we kind of looked at the first little bit of a section of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, a large chapter in one of the main letters that make up the New Testament. And those verses that we looked at, verses 1 to 11, they're the kind of verses that historians and apologists drool over, because they're early, they're close to the time that it happened, kind of 20 years, and they're sparse, they're not full of metaphor and poetry and simile, they're barely stated facts, and they reflect an oral tradition. It's not Paul saying, here's what I know, he says, here's what was passed on to me. So you've got 20 years, but then you're creeping back toward years or even months out from when it happened, because he's talking about what was passed on to him. So historians and apologists love verses 1 to 11 of 1 Corinthians. But the funny thing about 1 Corinthians 15, 1 to 11, is that for the church that it was first read out to, it was kind of tedious. It was intentionally kind of pedestrian and even slightly patronizing. Because the language is like, I want to remind you of the gospel that I've already preached to you. By this gospel, you are being saved. It's summarized by saying, this is what we preached, and this is what you believed. In Corinth, where the letter was read, you can imagine people rolling their eyes and saying, we're across this already. We've already heard this. We did this in Sunday school 3 weeks ago. It's not exciting for them. It's in their random access memory. It's there and it's available. And actually, the reason that Paul rehearses the thing that they already believe is not because they have forgotten it, but because they've forgotten the so what question. They've forgotten not that it happened, but what it means. They've forgotten the implication. And Paul says at the end of that section, he says, but if it is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? You see, what happened in Corinth has actually happened in Christian history many times over, that the Christians have been able to separate the death and resurrection of Jesus from the Christian hope. But it seems crazy when you put it like that, but Christians have been able to maintain this weird thing in their heads often, that there is the resurrection of Jesus, and that's one thing, and then there's our hope, and it's completely different, that Jesus was raised from the dead and that we will kind of float like souls to heaven. That Jesus was raised from the dead in his body, and that we want to escape our bodies and kind of be disembodied. And Paul is saying that that just makes no sense. That is a weird non sequitur in the light of what happened to Jesus. Because he says, and I quote again, if there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And in the verses that follow, Paul kind of pulls out the AK-47 and starts going at them with all the inconsistencies that make possible this idea that the resurrection of Jesus is different from the Christian hope. So he says, if there's no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. But you do believe in the resurrection of Jesus. How can you forget about the resurrection of the dead, of all people? Or he says, if there's no resurrection of the dead, and therefore Christ has not been raised, then our preaching and your faith is useless. He says in verse 15, if the dead are not raised and therefore Christ is not raised, then we're lying about God. Or in verse 17, if there's no resurrection of the dead, then you're still in your sins. But you don't believe that you're still in your sins. Then why would you not believe in the resurrection of the dead? Or verse 18, if there's no resurrection of the dead, those who have fallen asleep in Christ have perished. And that is not what you believe. You see, what Paul does in this great chapter of 1 Corinthians 15 is calls them on their inconsistency, on their ability to live with the resurrection of Jesus and not connecting that to the Christian hope. And so he summarizes it by saying, if in Christ we have hope only in this life, we of all people are to be most pitied. Yeah, or if I can put it this way, if you're a visitor to EU, so you're not normally part of the EU, but you've come along today, which is awesome, and the whole purpose of this week is that you could be here. But if you come and you work out that the resurrection of Jesus never happened, then a really charitable thing to do would be to start a group for ex-EUers and to try to coax them out of this crazy program of proclaiming the resurrection of Christ. Because Paul says to believe in the resurrection of Christ, if it's not true, is not just like a thing that gets you through the night. It's not just something that you think, well, at least it keeps the kids off the street and they take less drugs and stuff if they believe in the resurrection of the dead. So even if it's not true, let's just let them do it because it has certain social advantages. Paul says, on the contrary, if you've got any compassion for these poor EU people, then help them to see their fault. Because Paul says, if in Christ we have hope only for this life, then we above all people are to be pitied. But you see, Paul can talk like that because he is so confident that Jesus was raised from the dead. And he is so confident that they have believed that Jesus was raised from the dead. And he knows that the problem in Corinth, in the little church there, is not a lack of belief in the resurrection of Christ, but an inability to connect the resurrection of Christ with the Christian hope. You see, with that, we come up against the question, what does the death and resurrection in particular of Jesus achieve? If it happened, which we thought about last hour, what does it mean? What would it change about your life and my life if it were true? And Paul's answer is in verse 20. He says, but if in fact Christ has been raised, Christ has been raised as the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. Paul's answer to the connection between the resurrection of Jesus and the hope for humanity, his way of connecting what happened in the dark before the sun had come up on that Sunday morning in Jerusalem, and your life and my life and the whole creation, is to say that they connect because Jesus is the first fruits of the harvest to come. So it's a picture. So for pictures, you need imagination, so you need to think of a picture. You need to think of this. You need to think of an orchard. So imagine in your mind an orchard. You're the farmer, and you're looking out over the orchard. And the orchard, you see, is kind of dark and grim. You come through, say, a long winter, and the spring's just come. And you look up and you see that there is the first fruit on the tree. And Paul says the first fruit is Jesus, and the resurrection of the dead and the redemption of the cosmos is the harvest to come. You see, Jesus in his resurrection is the first fruits. And that means at least two things, that Jesus is the best and that he's the first. Firstly, in Jewish thinking, the first fruit is the best fruit. In the Old Testament, the farmers had to take their first fruit to God. So you couldn't, you know, the Old Testament Jewish system was you had to give 10% of your stuff to God in the harvest, and you'd present that at the temple. But you couldn't just think, oh, I'll get all the fruit that you couldn't sell at market and all the kind of skanky leftover fruit at the end of the season and make up the 10% that way. No, you had to take your first fruit because that was the best. And you took the first fruit to say to God that you deserve the best. And to call Jesus the first fruit is to say that he's God's best, that he is God's prime example of the new humanity. The first fruits were the best, but they were also the beginning. First fruits is first fruits of harvest to come. And the extraordinary thing about the Old Testament religion in that you had to give your first fruits to God is that that is a risky exercise. So you imagine that you're back there and you're that farmer and you've got the orchard. And as the winter gets darker and darker and the fruit gets less and less, and the stockpile that you put aside for you and your family is starting to get whittled down and whittled down, and at the very end, as the spring is just around the corner and the first fruit appears and you say, the kids are like, is there enough food? And you say, kids, you know what? We're going to give the first fruit to God, and we're going to trust him for the harvest. It was an act of entrustment. It was an act of faith to say, kids, we can trust God enough to know that if we give him the first fruits, then he will bring the harvest. And that's the picture that Paul uses to explain the resurrection of Jesus. What does it mean, and how does it connect with your life and my life and the cosmos? Paul says that Jesus, first of all, is the best. He's the best of the new humanity. He's what the Bible calls the last Adam. He's the new humanity. He's the best of the crop that's to come. He's humanity par excellence. He's the image of God in everything it was meant to be. He is humanity 2.0. He is humanity as it now bears the image of God. He is humanity taken out of sin and death and suffering, out of the brokenness of this world and into the new creation. Jesus is the best, but he's also the first fruit of the harvest, which is to say that the resurrection of Jesus is God's pledge that what he did for Jesus, he will do for everyone who is in Jesus. The resurrection of Jesus is God's pledge that what he did for Jesus, he will do for everyone who is in Jesus. And can you see, if you put it like that, you see that gap between what happened to Jesus and what will happen to those who trust in Jesus is kind of absurd. It's like the Corinthian church looked out over the harvest and thought, oh, there's a peach, I bet the rest are going to be figs. No, if the first thing is a peach, then you know that the whole harvest is peaches, that the first fruit on the tree is an indication of what the rest of the tree will be. And it's kind of mad to say, well, okay, God did a resurrection once. I wonder what he'll do next. And Paul's saying, he's going to do what he did first, because Jesus is the first fruit of the harvest to come. Now, I realize I've called on your imagination, but I want to push it one step further. It kind of gets weird here, because I want you to imagine the harvest and the farmer, but I want you to imagine an alien who's come from Mars, who's been sent on a PhD thesis exercise to write. I don't know, it's getting weird. Stick with me. He's been sent down to find out about agricultural methods on Earth with a view to implementing some of them back on Mars. So he sent this guy sent, the mothership comes down, he lands, you know, in the southern hemisphere in Australia. And his research scholarship, let's say it goes from early May to the end of August. And at the end of August, the Martian university runs out of funding and he gets beamed back up into the mothership and he's got to file away his reports to say, what's agriculture like on Earth? Is this a place that we could go and grow stuff? And the alien files the report, and what's it going to say between May and August? It's going to say, do you know what? It's not a good place. Everything's dying. Every day I was there, it got worse and worse and worse. There were less and less fruit. There was less and less of a harvest. Do you know what? I think that place is on its way out. And you know, and I know, that the problem is that he just got beamed up too early. Because if he had waited, the alien didn't realize that everything he saw indicated death, 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 that every day there was less fruit, less fruit, less fruit, less fruit. But on earth, there's a thing called spring. And in spring, the pattern of death is reversed. And the first fruit appears on a tree. And if the aliens' research funding only extended into September, he would have realized that this is a very fruitful planet. And that whole dying orchard was about to burst forth into life. You see, the alien looks at our world and sees death everywhere, and we look at our world and we see death everywhere. You know, if you're just working on empirical observations, what happens on this planet? People die, things die. That's just what happens. And everywhere you look, in every relationship, in every piece of biology, in every family, death always wins. Death conquers everything. There is no relationship you're in, there is no family that you could be a part of, there is no community that you can share in that isn't haunted by death. There is no one that you love who will not be one day ripped away from you by death. And so I think just on empirical grounds, if you look at this world, death wins every time. Except the Bible says that Jesus is the first fruits of the harvest to come. That Jesus, by his resurrection, introduces something radical and new into our world, namely a reversal of death. An instance where death is not the conqueror, but death is conquered. And so in the resurrection of Jesus, we're introduced to a whole new paradigm for living life in this world, which is not life now, death then, but death now, life then. Let me try to explain that. In the passage that I'm thinking through as we talk, Paul says, characterizes the way of life that is life then death with a verse where he says, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." And for Paul, that lifestyle captures life apart from the resurrection. Let us eat and drink now. Why? Because tomorrow we die. And I think that is a rational and reasonable lifestyle if all that you see is true, that everything gives way to death, that death always wins, that death is the last word on every life and every family and every community. That is rational. Eat and drink now because tomorrow you die. And lots of people, of course, live like that, whether in the more audacious expression of eating and drinking and dancing and parties and chemically enhanced moods and living for your own pleasure, or whether it's that more respectable style of the good qualifications, the accumulation of property and a killer superannuation. Whichever way you look at that, it's a lifestyle that has accepted the status quo. Let us eat and drink now because tomorrow we die. And it's kind of ironic because it looks like it's kind of pumping on the outside. But on the inside, that lifestyle is shaped by death. It's shaped by the knowledge that one day death, like the mafia boss, like the bully in the playground, is going to walk into your life and demand his slice of the action. And as the experiences roll on and as you accumulate and grab and take, death is just off stage left saying, "Buddy, you've only got a little bit of time. You've only got a little bit of time to keep grabbing." And I think that does shape many of our lives. That is why it matters so much that you party hard now, that you're only 20 once, that you have that experience now, that you grab that sex now, that you have that money now, that you go to that place now. I think it's why in the workplace, people make decisions and say, "Well, I'm going to tread on that person. Because if I don't grab that promotion, then that promotion may never come to me again." And that is death calling the shots. That is death way off stage saying, "Yep, grab it, push them, move, take." And it's an ugly way to live. But that's just the way death rolls. That's what death does. And you look at the orchard between April, May, June, July, August, and it looks like death is exactly correct, that everything fits with his narrative, that if you don't grab, death always wins. And we just say, "Yes, sir. Do you mind if I just play for a little bit longer? Can I just grab one more thing? Can I just push out one more person out of the road?" And it's a way of life that has at its heart unremitting despair. But the meaning of the resurrection of Jesus is that a new way of life is possible. A way of life that isn't shaped by life, then death, but a way of life that is shaped by death, then life. It's the exact opposite. The way the Christian life is lived, the life that is brought online in the resurrection of Jesus is one where Paul says he faces danger every day. He endangers himself. He fought wild beasts at Ephesus. He lives a life of sacrifice, a life of not grabbing but giving, a life of not pushing, but a life of making room for others. It looks like a life of sacrifice. It looks like a life where opportunities pass you by. But Paul knows the secret, that Jesus is the first fruits of the harvest to come. And a life that knows that secret looks so different. It's like knowing, you know the film The Sixth Sense? It's like knowing that the psychologist himself is dead. Sorry if I ruined that for you. He's dead. It's like knowing, you know, the Kevin Spacey character in The Usual Suspects, and turns out that he's in the whole thing. He's getting interviewed. He looks really meek and mild. It turns out he is actually the mafia boss that they're chasing. Again, sorry about that film, ruining that for you. Or if you've seen Hannah Montana, it turns out that the girl with the rig that's actually Hannah Montana, and she's dancing, and she's also Miley. Again, sorry to ruin that for you. And to believe in the resurrection of Jesus is to know the secret plot line at the heart of the universe. The secret plot line that death has been reversed, that death doesn't win, that life wins, that Jesus has been raised to life again, and that he's the first fruits of the harvest to come. Now, I get that Christianity is kind of prickly. I get that from the outside, it's like that sexual ethic, really, and going to church, really, and living at that code, really. I get that from the outside, it's a kind of prickly proposition. But cross my heart and hope to die, honestly, at the center of the Christian faith is unremitting joy. Because Christ has conquered the grave, because he's been risen, because he is the first fruits and he is the promise of the harvest to come. The weird thing about Christianity is that at the outside, it looks kind of conservative. In fact, it's a religion for radicals. Because it is a cosmic rebellion against death and sin. It is a cosmic rebellion religion, because everything you see says death wins, and Christianity doesn't say death you win, it says death you suck. Death, you're going down. Death, the first fruits of your failure to shape our lives has come, because the first fruit is there on the tree. It's a religion for radicals. It's a rebellion against the status quo. We've got 2 days left, I think, or one day left, two talks, and we want to think together about what it looks like to live that life, what it would look like for a man or a woman to entrust themselves to Jesus, to live that cosmic rebellion against death. But I can tell you now, it looks like trusting him. It looks like entrusting yourself to him. Faith is not believing in spite of the evidence. Faith is entrusting yourself to the one that you have good reason to trust. And to trust Jesus is to trust that the first fruits of God's rebellion against death have already appeared, that the dark days of Narnia are nearly over, where it was always winter but never Christmas. That's coming to an end, because the Christian faith says that Aslan is now off the stone table. He's taking down your enemies, and spring is appearing like wherever he puts his feet. That's the Christian hope. Thanks for your attention.
We've got a time of questions. Cool. Are you going to stay up there?
No, good.
The light off the stage. If you've got questions, please send them through to the number and keep them coming. The first question is related to that last kind of thing that you were just talking about trusting Jesus. This person has asked, in the first hour you said that faith is like body slamming a glass floor showing that you trusted it. If you weren't there, then maybe explain that. We can't body slam Jesus, so what does really trusting him look like?
That's great. So the analogy from last time was, I won't go into it, but we'll use a less dramatic one. So trusting a chair is to not just believe that the chair could hold your weight, but to put your weight on the chair. Or one that I thought of in the break is, which I kind of find attractive for perverse reasons, is that you're at the casino and you're playing poker and you think you've got a good hand and you get all your chips and saying, I'm all in. It's all or nothing. And that's what Christian faith in Jesus looks like. It's putting all your chips on him. How that cashes out in a life is the obedience of faith, to use a phrase from the Apostle Paul, which is to entrust yourself to Jesus is to walk by faith, not by sight, which is to live for him in the way that you choose your activities. So for some examples, maybe you're choosing between a year on a Kentucky tour of Europe and just like going mental, or a year in an orphanage in Africa. And I'm not claiming to know the mind of Jesus, but I think most people here could guess which one Jesus would be slightly more in favour of, right? Is that hard to work out? Now, walking by faith and not by sight is to think, okay, the Kentucky tour would be amazing, but Jesus would want me to be in the orphanage. I'm going to trust him and get on the plane to Africa rather than Europe. Does that make sense? Or to think, here's this relationship and I want to be sexually active in it or whatever, and that's not, and in Christian faith, sex is for commitment of marriage, and you think, I've got this by sight, that's what I want to do, by faith I'm going to trust Jesus that this is best for us. Or with your money, with your life, with the way you treat people, when you want to fight back at work or at uni, and you just think, I just want to dominate that person and just humiliate them because of what they did to me. You think, but I'm going to trust Jesus because he says the way of death, then life, is the true heart of the universe. I think that's what it looks like to have faith in Jesus, to put your weight on him.
Cool. Someone has asked what practical difference it makes to live a life of sacrifice and trust. Is there no room for personal ambition and achievement?
Yeah, I don't want to do false advertising. I think every chip's in with Jesus. That's a scary thing, and maybe it would be we get more people if we didn't say that, but that's true. Like, you've got your hand at the casino and every chip's in. So I think in advance, to entrust yourself to Jesus is to say, I'm all in, I'm 100%. And you do that wherever Jesus leads you. So I don't want to give you the impression that if you're tinkering on the edge and you think, can I hold on to a particular ambition or a particular dream or whatever, I think, to be honest, it's kind of all in. Now, having put yourself all in on Jesus, can I say on the other side of that, he'll love you to death, you'll have joy and hope in life, and if you trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, all your ways, acknowledge him, he'll direct your path, and that includes him vindicating you and raising you up and so on. But the act of faith is to say, I'm all in.
This person has asked, some see death as not a terrible thing, rather just an important facet of life on earth. Why do you see death as so much of a problem? There's sure a sadness to it, but that's the same with all elements of life. Is death really such a problem in a naturalistic world?
Yeah, that's in my kind of weird counter ministry of giving you ways to not be Christian. I think, a thing that a lot of religions have done is to try to help you come to terms with death, to say, well, can't we think of death as cyclical and that you need death and that death is in a sense kind of beautiful, or at least that you could reconcile yourself to death. And I just think on that one, you're kind of looking for another religion. Like, Christianity is just so radically opposed to death, it's not funny. It like really hates it and really wants to mount a cosmic rebellion against it. And, you know, I'm up for that. Yeah. Anyway, that's...
This person has asked, if the heart of the Christian faith is joy, like you said, unremitting joy, why all the talk of strange ethics and odd practices and a coffin on the stage doesn't really say joy?
Irony? Yeah.
I'd suggest,
you tell me, Steph.
What if death is not the end? Question mark, rhetorical question. So maybe...
I don't know, is it just, it's kind of like an emo aesthetic that it's just, yeah. Yep, dark, cool.
Rory's got eyeliner on. The person has asked, actually, I've got a question for you. Ditch this question. If you have more questions, please send them through, as you have done. Some people suggest that at the creation of the world, before the fall in which humanity sinned, there may have been death in the non-human created order. Is that something that you would think would be in the new creation?
Hmm. I don't know. I am, as far as I've thought about it, I am kind of, you know, okay with the idea of death being part of the pre-fallen animal world or whatever, that I think the immortality of Adam and Eve was conditional on eating from the tree of life. Like, I don't think it was a property of their own soul that they would just live forever, like that they could jump off massive buildings and just go crazy because nothing could happen to them. I think that it was. I think the symbolism of the tree of life is that there's a contingency to their ongoing existence, and there's a, to use it, theological word, there's an eschatology even in the garden. So even before the fall, before humanity rebelled against God, the world was not evil but was incomplete. It was imperfect, and that Adam and Eve were God's partners in bringing the world to its fullness. And in the fall, the promises that come as the world is given over to death are bigger than the original promises given in the garden. And so in Isaiah, for example, it talks about the lion and the lamb lying down together in the new creation, which I get is poetic. Like, I'm not sure that that's... Anyway, I get that that's Isaiah's way of saying it's going to be brilliant, but maybe kind of literally there's something about the new creation that will not just be a repeat of Eden, but an even more death-free, gorgeous, like, great world.
It. How was Paul so confident in the resurrection of Jesus when he neither witnessed the death nor the resurrection of the guy? Can whatever convinced him convince people now too?
Yeah, I think there's two lines of evidence in Paul that make him a really compelling person to grapple with if you're trying to work out the truth of the resurrection. The first one is that he was an anti-Christian religious terrorist when he met Jesus. So in terms of, it would be like, and I don't mean to be flippant about this, but I think it's fair. It would be like finding that Osama bin Laden wanted to sign up with the American Republican Party and run for Congress. It's that kind of change. It's like opposite world. That he was, Jesus, Paul was literally going to literally kill Christians and met the risen Jesus. And so it was not in any way to his advantage. His life got a lot worse in many ways after meeting Jesus. But he really believed that he had met Jesus, and there was this extraordinary change into opposite world when he did. And secondly, in a kind of weird little social experiment, Paul had 14 years of isolation from the other apostles. And so Paul didn't meet Jesus in his life, meets the risen Jesus while he's an active anti-Christian terrorist. His life changes, and then he goes to Arabia, and for 14 years he has no contact with the other apostles. And then they get together 3 years after the 14 years, according to Galatians, and have a council. And the guys that knew Jesus for 3 years say to Paul, "What's your gospel? What are you telling people about Jesus?" And they share notes, and they say, "Yep, that's exactly what we're saying." Even to the point, actually, where the guys that were friends with Jesus submit to Paul on a technical point, because Paul's right and they're wrong. So that, in terms of a social science experiment, that's a pretty good one. That complete isolation, and you think about the emotional impact of that, that Paul has killed people you know. So the church is not big. It's not like there's Christians to spare. Paul's killed people you know. Then he meets the risen Jesus. Then he preaches the risen Jesus in isolation for 14 years. And then you go and meet with this guy and you're like, oh, my auntie's sister was killed by your guys. And now you're preaching Jesus and you're saying exactly the same as what we're saying. I think that's a pretty compelling series of events. Yeah.
If there's such a great hope after death, should we be sad at death and funerals?
Yeah, I think, here we go, this weird topic, but like what should happen at Christian funerals. Since World War I, Christian funerals and Christian liturgies have veered away from talking about the resurrection of the dead. So if you go to a Western cemetery or an Australian cemetery, before World War I, most of the gravestones will talk about the hope of the resurrection. But in World War I, you had a whole series of mothers that had no body to bury of their sons. There was no body to put in the grave. And there's a cultural change where we started talking about rest in peace or about he's now in heaven or he's now with God, which is a completely understandable tweak given the grief of the mothers in World War I. Does that make sense? But it has changed Christian practices forever. And so Christian funerals have become quite flower-ridden and heavenly-oriented. But if you use a Catholic or Anglican liturgy, like the Australian Book of Common Prayer or the Catholic equivalent or whatever, the old liturgies don't have any of that in it. They're rebellion services. And they say to death, okay, you won this round, death, but Jesus wins the whole thing. And so Christian funeral services are kind of like a finger sign to death. And if you read the liturgies, that's what they're like. So I would prefer us to come back toward that. I don't think they have to be like the other funeral services I was talking about where there's no redemptive thing. I think we do say Jesus has conquered, but I think at a funeral we have to acknowledge that death won a battle, but it won't win the war.
If humans wrecked God's first perfect creation, will they be able to do that again in the new creation? Or do we not have free will anymore in the new creation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. St. Augustine, like the early Christian thinker, has an answer to this, which, see if you find it satisfying, because it's a genuine, like, what the question. But Augustine says that in the first garden, humans had freedom and they used it to sin. In this creation, in this present age, we don't have the freedom not to sin, that we're enslaved to sin. Right, which that's an experiment you can do in the next week and just see how you go. But Augustine says that true freedom is when we can't choose to sin. And so he thinks that in the new creation, we will be ultimately free precisely when our ability to choose sin and evil is taken away from us. Anyway, that was his thought.
Why is the Christian hope really different to the hope of other faiths, which try and comfort people in the face of the reality of death?
Great. Two things there. So, in actual fact, and this is one of the things that New Atheism has kind of made us a bit confused about, and we've helped with it. A lot of faiths aren't about what happens after you die. Like, the idea that the purpose of religion is to comfort you in death is maybe true of Christianity, not really true of Judaism, somewhat true of Islam, and not really to do with Buddhism and Hinduism, and certainly not to do with the ancient pagan religions, which offered, you know, Zeus and Hermes and Aphrodite and stuff. They had nothing to say about your death, and it wasn't about death. So the idea that religions are primarily about comforting you when you're dead is a kind of Western imposition onto the rest of the world's religions that's not actually really what they're about. Having said that, a lot of religions have something to say about death, and normally in Eastern religion, it's to reconcile you to the patterns of the world of death and reincarnation or karma or so on. And I think they're all intuitive shots at trying to make sense of the senselessness of death.
Great. If you want to ask Rory any more questions, feel free to grab him afterwards. But how about we thank him for his time?